Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll remember one of America's greatest writers, Mark Twain, who grew up along the Mississippi River. A biography of Twain examines his life from his early days in Hannibal, Missouri, to becoming a literary giant. He had his triumphs and a lot of financial hardships. On our history segment, we'll recall the various state mottos for Illinois. 150 years ago, a Kentucky community had a wild occurrence, meat falling from the sky. That event is still being remembered. We'll visit a school where students are learning how to fix hair and introduce you to a high school student behind what may soon be a new state law that could save lives. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. The Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer Ron Chernow discusses his book, Mark Twain, which paints a nuanced portrait of a complicated American author from the heartland. Twain had many challenges, including too much debt in his immediate family and a long litany of financial hardships that nearly crushed him. But Chernow says Twain can be credited with transforming American literature by writing about the individuals and landscapes of the Midwest, which up until that point enjoyed little representation in fiction. He talked with Steve Kraske.
Ron, welcome.
Lovely to be with you, Steve. Thanks for having me.
So why Mark Twain? Why now, Ron?
Well, you know, my obsession with Mark Twain dates back to 1974. I was a 25-year-old freelance magazine writer in Philadelphia. And one night I saw there were posters up that said Mark Twain tonight, exclamation point. And it was a one-man show by the actor Hal Holbrook.
Absolutely.
He stood up there for 90 minutes in the trademark white suit with the cigar and the unruly hair. And he spouted one political witticism after another that had me howling with laughter. He said, there's no distinctly Native American criminal class, except for Congress. Or he said, suppose you're an idiot, and suppose you're a congressman, but I repeat myself. He said, I say it with pride, that we have legislatures that fetch higher prices than any other in the world. Anyway, I was not only howling with laughter at this, but it amazed me that these were lines that were more than 100 years old, that were still so fresh and funny, and unfortunately still so pertinent. So that began this lifelong obsession with Twain, not only in terms of Twain as a novelist, but Twain is an all-purpose political pundit, and Twain is, in many ways, is our original celebrity. I mean, he anticipates this whole influencer culture that engulfs us now.
How did he do that? Because that's one of your points in this book, that he practically invented celebrity culture. How did he do it?
I think that he did it in a couple of ways. You know, he realized that to become a modern celebrity, you have to be an instantly recognizable figure. So he began this trademark white suit.
Right.
Now, the first time he appeared in the white suit, the reporter said to him, what's the meaning of this? And he said, this is the uniform of the American Association of Purity and Perfection, of which I am the president and sole member. And then he did other things, like he was very colorful. He would give interviews sitting up in bed in his nightshirt. He was a little bit like Groucho Marx in that way. But he also lent his name and image to a lot of product endorsements, something that it's hard to imagine a Henry James or an Edith Wharton doing. For instance, the Wirt Fountain Pen Company signed him up, and not only would have Mark Twain's name and image, but he wrote the copy for them. So he wrote in the copy that with one Wirt pen, I have supported my family for many years. With two Wirt pens, I could have grown rich. I mean, what other author of that time, our own time, would have lent himself to that sort of publicity? But he loved, from the time that he was a boy, he loved attention, and that didn't fail him throughout his life.
The white suit thing, we think of him always in a white suit, but that didn't begin until pretty late in his life, right?
Yeah, where he wore only the white suits, that was the last 4 years. In fact, he bought 14 of them, so that he had one for each day of the week while the seven others were at the cleaners. He said that he was the only cleanly clothed person in a dirty world, and he became increasingly, you know, pessimistic about the state of humanity. In fact, in his later years, he said that if he had created humanity, he would have hidden his head in a bag in shame.
Ron Chernow, the great biographer, is my guest. His new book is titled simply Mark Twain. You know, we all think of him, you know, as a fun uncle or a to-die-for grandfather, but is that really who he was?
You know, he could be irreverent and charming and utterly delightful, but also kind of very, you know, moody and temperamental. Mm-hmm. He married a very rich and very refined woman named Livy Langdon from upstate New York. And as Twain himself admitted, he was a mighty rough, coarse customer when they met. And she had to train him in anger management. He was a very volatile personality, so that he had a tendency to dash off angry and impetuous letters. And she taught him, after he wrote the letter, to stash it in the drawer for a few days until he cooled down. Or there are a lot of letters in his papers where the morning after a dinner party, you'd see Mark Twain writing to someone. The madam tells me I may have been a little sharp and brusque with you at dinner last night, and I apologize. Uh-huh. But, you know, they actually worked out because she was making him presentable in polite society. They worked out a system of color-coded cards. A red card that she flashed meant to him, are you going to monopolize that woman on your right all night? a blue card meant, are you going to sit back and not say anything throughout the dinner party? They adored each other. It was a happy, I mean, there's hardly a letter from Livy to Mark or Sam Clemens, as he was originally born. There's hardly a letter that he wrote to her that she wrote to him that didn't end, I adore you, I worship you, I idolize you, and that was fully reciprocated. And the daughters used to call this process of mother training father, mother dusting off father, and Twain himself admitted in later life, Livy edited my manuscripts and then she edited me.
Well, he stuffed so much living into his 74 years, Ron. That's comes through so clearly in this book. You almost can't believe he still managed to churn out as many words as he did. What's your sense? How did he manage it all?
Well, you know, first I should mention, because most people, if they have read Mark Twain these days, maybe they've read, you know, Tom Sawyer, Huck Finn, maybe Life on the Mississippi.
Right.
But he published two dozen books in his lifetime. Most people don't know he published a novel on Joan of Arc. He published a book about Mary Baker Eddy, he didn't like, the founder of Christian Science. He even published a book about Shakespeare. He was fanatically convinced that the plays that we attribute to Shakespeare were written by Francis Bacon. So he was constantly writing about thousands of magazine articles. It was really difficult to keep up with him, even though he would always describe himself as very lazy, and yet he left behind probably the best documented record of any American writer.
I was going to say, given all that, how easily did the writing come to him, Ron? Because you write in here that at one point during the writing of Huckleberry Finn, that he was turning out dozens of pages of manuscript a day. He was so focused. It was really something to behold.
Yeah, although I have to mention, you know, he would write on sheets with a very large lettering.
Mm.
And the reason that he did that is he loved to say at the end of the day, I wrote 50 pages today. It might be his handwriting had been a little smaller. Mm. It would have been a dozen and it wouldn't have sounded quite as impressive. He had a method of writing unlike that of any writer I've encountered. So he would work on a novel for 6 months. He would kind of lose his original head of steam. Then he would pick up another unfinished novel. Sometimes he was working on 3 or 4 novels simultaneously. And it was not unusual, like in the case of Huck Finn went on for about 7 years, I think Mark Twain 3 years. I'm not aware of any writer who would have been able to keep re-entering the mood another book, particularly having jumped off to several others in the meantime.
So your sense of him today, having completed the book, was he America's finest author?
No, I don't think so. I think that he wrote several indisputably great books. I think that, you know, Huck Finn was his masterpiece.
Right.
But, you know, I was attracted to him, Steve, almost as much as Mark Twain the all-purpose political pundit, you know, Mark Twain, the original celebrity. Early in his career, he was very reluctant to express his real views, particularly his political views. But where most of us mellow as we get older, Twain became more fearless and outspoken, and really, it's a figure that's kind of common now. Somebody whom the reporters would knew that they could always get something fresh and funny and original from him. So he spoke out on all sorts of things, and a lot of things that he said today I think are still very relevant. He was infuriated by the expression, "My country, right or wrong." He said, our country we should support always. Our government we should support only when it deserves it. He was also very bothered by the hyper-partisanship of his day. He made the statement that if the Democrats adopted the multiplication table in their electoral platform, the Republicans would vote it down at the next election. You know, and he was also, and, you know, as a former journalist and as a biographer, you know, I love the fact he was a big defender of freedom of the press. He said that reverence is the surest defense of liberty. And one of my favorite lines is he said that the devil's aversion to holy water is a light matter compared to a despot's dread of a newspaper that laughs. A very handy line.
What did he ultimately bring to our literature that hadn't been brought to it before, Ron?
Well, you know, he liked to say that he never wrote for the cultivated classes, that he wrote for the masses. He said the cultivated classes could go to the theater and opera. He had no need to entertain them. He once said that fine literature was like wine. He said his writing was like water. Then he paused and added, "But everyone drinks water." So I think that what he added was that he took, you know, for one thing, of course, he grew up in Hannibal, Missouri, on the Mississippi. So he was right smack in the middle of the country. He once wrote, "I am not an American, I am the American." And it is arrogant, but perhaps there was truth to it. So he took a lot of kind of ordinary people and wrote books about them in their own voice. So here's this whole kind of, you know, the literary world had been very much dominated by kind of the Eastern Seaboard elite. And here he's capturing all this kind of, you know, wild, throbbing energy out there in the heartland, all the sort of, you know, wild men who populate our country who had not found their way into fiction before. So he really opened it up. And also when he wrote Huck Finn, suddenly, you know, here was a book not only about this street urchin and gutter snipe, but narrated by that street urchin and gutter snipe in his own voice. This is really quite revolutionary in American letters.
You know, you're obviously have some background in taking on these huge personalities, these people of massive accomplishment, George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, Ulysses S. Grant. What was the particular challenge for you in tackling this book on Mark Twain?
Well, it turned out that he was just a much, much more complicated character than I had ever imagined. And also, he had nine lives. I mean, his father dies at 11, and he becomes a printer's devil. Then he's a steamboat pilot on the Mississippi. Then he tries his hand at mining in Nevada. Then he becomes a journalist. Then he becomes, a novelist. I spend a lot of time on the book that he was inventor and an investor, and failed in almost everything that he tried. And the tragedy, the irony of his life is he made a fortune from his books and his lecture fees. And his bride, Livy Langdon, was an heiress. They built a 25-room mansion in Hartford, Connecticut, with a loyal staff of six servants. They could have had the easiest and most placid life imaginable, but because of his compulsive urge to speculate in different investments, he goes bankrupt, and the family is forced into exile in Europe for 9 years to economize. So we think of him as the quintessential American writer, but he spent extensive periods living in Berlin, Vienna, Paris, London, and all he spent 11 years of his life outside the United States, so that this, again, American from the heartland, was actually quite worldly and cosmopolitan and spent more time outside the country than anyone else. So this was kind of a lot to encompass. You know, writing about Mark Twain, you find you have a real tiger by the tail. You have to hold on pretty tight.
You have so many interesting little nuggets in here. This, I thought, was really interesting. He, you know, Twain obviously has this incredible imagination, but you write in here that the original idea for one of his most popular books, which was Life on the Mississippi, it actually wasn't his idea. Whose was it?
Yeah, it was actually his friend Joseph Twitchell.
Right.
At first, this is a very strange thing, because at first it didn't seem to occur to him, okay, he's grown up in Hannibal, Missouri. That's all the way up in the northeast corner of Missouri. It's a very beautiful, very kind of isolated rural area. Is living in this mansion in Hartford. And at first it doesn't seem to occur to him to reach back into his own early life. And, of course, that for him is the mother lode. You know, that's the gold mine. And his friend Joseph Twitchell, who was a close friend and a minister, suggested to him that he write about the Mississippi. And his years, it took him 2 years to get a pilot's license on the Mississippi. As he said, the steamboat pilots on the Mississippi were the kind of undisputed royalty at the time. And that period was extremely important. He said, oh, that was the darling existence. There was nothing he enjoyed more. And just as a writer, that experience on the Mississippi for several years brought him in contact with every type of humanity. He had kind of a wonderful, you know, ear for dialogue and slang, so he's kind of picking up all of this language. He has time to read as well. So it's very, very strange that it's not until he's really in his 30s and 40s that it begins to occur to him that he can take his very colorful childhood. Tom Sawyer is very much, you know, Mark Twain's self-portrait of his boyhood in terms of someone who was sort of mischievous and always hunting for adventure and gerbil fantasies. But it was late. And I think what happened, it was kind of only when he was really kind of comfortably settled in a marriage with family that in his imagination he could begin to reach back into the town of Hannibal and all of his experiences.
More from biographer Ron Chernow talking about his latest book, Mark Twain. That's ahead on Statewide. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. We continue our conversation with biographer Ron Chernow talking about his book, Mark Twain. He's speaking with Steve Kraske.
Let's talk about race just for a few minutes here.
Yep.
Obviously, Huckleberry Finn continues to be controversial, if only because of Twain's rampant use of the N-word throughout that book. What should we make of that today? I mean, some people would still conclude he was a racist. Was he a racist?
No, exactly the opposite. Mm. He starts out, okay, he grows up in a slave-owning family in a slave-owning town. You read his teenage letters, crude racist remarks. You know, as his life goes on, he becomes the most broad-minded and intolerant of all white authors in the 20th century. I mean, Huckleberry Finn is the great anti-slavery,
right,
you know, novel language. He's using the N-word 200 times, not to endorse slavery, but to expose the slavery that has pervaded the minds of Huck and these other people. I mean, what other white author of the 19th century would have said that American liberty should date not from 1776, but 1865, when slavery was abolished? Or he mockingly said that the Declaration of Independence should have said all white men are created equal. He ended up paying for the education of two black students, one of them Warner T. McGuinn, at Yale Law School. Twain wrote to the dean of the law school and said, we have ground the manhood out of them, the blacks, and the shame is ours, that he felt personally responsible as a white man for the wrong that had been done to the black race. Warner T. McGuinn ended up becoming a famous lawyer and a mentor to Thurgood Marshall, who argued Brown versus Board of Ed and became the first black associate justice of the Supreme Court.
Right.
So as Twain goes on, there's no sort of greater friend of the black community than Mark Twain. And so the N-word, which I understand the discomfort that it creates now, but it should not be misconstrued in terms of a reflection on Mark Twain's racism.
You know, another interesting nugget from this book, 220 pages in, you mention a woman named Mary Ann Cord. She was black,
yeah.
She was a cook, and she had been born into slavery. Fascinating conversation she has one day with Mark Twain, who asked her point blank, how is it that you've lived 60 years and never had any trouble? He's thinking, looking at her as someone who has glided through life, not really having been slowed down because of the color of her skin. How did she respond to that, Ron? And what did Twain take away from that? Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, he used to spend his summers in Elmira, New York, where his in-laws had a farm. And there was this wonderful cook, Mary Ann Cord. She was a hardy black woman in her 60s or 70s. She always had a laugh on her lips. And Mark Twain asked her one day at sunset, they're sitting on the porch, hey, how is it you haven't had any trouble in your life? And she turned on him and she said, are you in earnest, Mr. Clemens?
Yes, right.
She couldn't believe that he had asked that naive question. Well, she then began to spill out her entire life story, which was that she had indeed been born into slavery. In slavery, had been married and had seven children. She and her husband and the seven children were put up on the block at a slave auction. And in an instant, you know, her husband and seven children were torn away from her. She never saw her husband again, and she never saw six of the seven children again. And she then said mockingly at the end, oh, no, I've never had any trouble, Mr. C.
Wow.
And what he did was that he then published in the Atlantic Monthly an article called The True Story, repeated, you know, word for word as I heard it. It was actually the first article under his byline that appeared in the Atlantic Monthly. And he said later in his life, because Mark Twain was a pen name for Sam Clemens, he said later in his life that he was sorry that he had not created two pen names. He was always concerned that if he wrote something serious, like the article about Mary Ann Cord, that readers who always expected something funny from him would be disappointed. So he was sorry he had not established a pen name for the funny stuff, and then another name for all the serious stuff that was on his mind.
Interesting. You write in the book that in revising Huckleberry Finn, he winds up shifting the slavery subplot to become the main focus of the narrative. Why did he make that switch? And I assume this was a huge change in what this book became.
Yeah, well, you know, Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn both take place in the same town. It's called St. Petersburg in the fiction. It was actually Hannibal in reality. When he did Tom Sawyer, which is a very, very charming book about, you know, American boyhood innocence, it was his town, but it was his town without slavery. And I think as he started to write Huck, he realized that, you know, this gigantic blot on the whole town was slavery that just permeated everything that that happened. And it's interesting, the other controversy with Huck Finn has to do with the portrayal of Jim. Now, Jim is, on the one hand, far and away the most sensitive and dignified and affectionate character in the book. The whites are almost all violent and crude and profane, but there are certain, it's called minstrel affectations of Jim. You know, he's superstitious, he's credulous. And so, you know, black critics going back 75 years, and not just black critics, you know, have argued that there was sort of, you know, traits from minstrel shows that were grafted onto to Jim. And I think there's some truth to that. And it was the reason that Percival Everett, in his wonderful book, James, decided to retell the story from Jim / James's point of view and get rid of, you know, the racist caricatures. And so it's not, you know, it's a great book. It's not a perfect book. I don't think that a white author writing about race relations in the 19th century could have published a book that we would consider perfect today. I think it's amazing that Mark Twain went as far as he did. The fact that he didn't reach the promised land, I think, shouldn't entirely surprise us.
You write in here that he once said that Tom Sawyer was really himself. Does that make sense to you today, Ron?
Yeah, I think so, because Mark Twain said, you know, from the time that he was a boy, he said that celebrity is what a boy loves more than anything else. He would be a pirate, he would be a clown, he would sell himself to the devil if he could attract the attention and notice of other boys. And so I point out his entire life he was trying to attract attention. He admitted that he had an appetite for notice and notoriety, and he did tell his daughters that the character of Tom Sawyer was really a self-portrait, and there was all of these different things that he had done and said as a boy.
That's biographer Ron Chernow, his book titled Mark Twain. He's added Twain to the list of subjects he's written about. He spoke with Steve Kraske. The Supreme Court's recent decision to cut key parts of the Voting Rights Act has already led to redistricting across the South, but it has implications for Illinois, too. Peter Medlin talked with the NIU professor, Scott Schroffnagel, about that and a bill that Senator Dick Durbin has introduced multiple times to restore the Voting Rights Act.
The Voting Rights Act of 1965 has different sections to it, right? And in Section 4, provided a formula that said that if states had participated in discriminatory voting practices of any kind, they would then need pre-clearance for any changes in their laws. This was the Shelby County v. Holder decision. So what the Supreme Court said is that formula that has been used, it had been updated a couple of times, is out of date.
Can you talk a little bit about just what that legislation would do and how that compares to the original version of the Voting Rights Act?
What the Durbin legislation did was just try to create a new formula that would specify, you know, the kind of voting irregularities and voting violations and so forth that would now be considered grounds for the need for preclearance of changes to their voting laws. When this decision was handed down, everybody, I think, knew that there's no way we're going to be able to pass a new formula in today's sort of poisoned or partisan, you know, legislative environment. But Durbin, to his credit, tried, right? He was made an effort to develop a new formula to replace the old one.
As recently as last year, introduced the legislation.
Yeah, right. But now this is a very different issue than the Louisiana-Calais decision, which has to do with Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act.
Now that we have this case that just get decided, do you think that would cause that legislation to have to recalibrate? Do you think they're less likely? Do you think they're second-guessing? Even if they passed it, it would be considered unconstitutional based on the way the Supreme Court is reading the Voting Rights Act at this point?
So the Durbin legislation, let's assume for a second that we could get that passed. And so we would create a new formula for Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act and keep the, you know, and if you're the formula points to you, then you're going to need to get preclearance of any changes to your voting laws. That could still be a factor, right? There's no reason why that wouldn't still work as a law. This particular decision it could have been decided in a way that it would apply to this Louisiana case and this Louisiana case only, but that's not what the majority opinion does. And it's got implications because there's majority-minority districts in local government here in Illinois, around the country. All of those are ripe for a challenge now.
Oh, really? So even in Illinois, we could see results? Can you talk just again briefly? I know you've had only limited time of what that could look like on even the local level somewhere in Illinois.
If there was a city in Illinois that wanted to try to make sure that Black residents got some sort of, you know, representation, you know, and they drew lines in a manner to try to make that happen, those lines could be challenged now. You know,
even a district like a city council district.
City council races and county commission races and the like, especially if someone could make the case that the intent was a majority-minority district.
City government, I mean, we deal with these same boundaries and we're talking about local school boards too, like all sorts of local government bodies.
Absolutely.
That's NIU professor Scott Schroffnagel, and he spoke with education reporter Peter Medlin about how Illinois could feel the fallout from the Supreme Court's recent decision to restrict the Voting Rights Act. Think back to middle school. Maybe you were part of the drama club or on the debate team. One Rockford school has a club that not only boosts students' confidence, but also enhances their appearance. Yvonne Booz tells us more.
It's Tuesday afternoon at Flynn Middle School, and the halls are jam-packed with students making their way out of the building. Most are headed home, but some will stick around for the Hair to Beauty Club, On this day, more than 24 students show up. The class is a mix of ethnicities, Black, white, and Hispanic girls. Because of this, the girls are taught how to style different hair textures.
Next session is the last one. It's a party.
Tiana Lambert is the school's registrar and organizer of the club. She's a licensed cosmetologist who started doing hair in middle school, and today she's doing middle schoolers' hair.
When they have a hair crisis, I take them around the corner from my desk and I fix their hair. So I've done anything from edges to ponytails to full head of braids to fixing locks.
When Lambert mentions edges, she's referring to a smoothing technique around the hairline. This is also known as laying down edges. The process involves applying hair gel for a smooth finish. Lambert's attention to students' hair got parents talking. They approached her about creating a beauty club.
I had to go to the building principal of the school. I spoke with one of the teachers here, and I was like, I don't know. And I'm like, and he gave the green light. He's like, absolutely.
Donors gave the club a styling chair, hair tools, and products, as well as providing their services. People from the Cosmetology and Spa Academy drop in occasionally, and Lambert has brought in a barber and other beauty experts. Today is Samantha Hart, a realtor, but hairstyling is one of her hobbies.
Today, it's a little bit of learning how to French braid, because that's the basis of crocheting hair into your head. So the ones who want to learn how to French braid, and then the ones who already know how to French braid, I'm just showing them how to actually crochet the hair in and how to take it out.
You may be thinking of yarn when you hear the word crochet, but this is all about hair. The technique is done by adding synthetic or natural hair to the client's own hair. The tool is made differently from a standard crochet needle. It has a hook latch that closes.
We actually latch the hair weave to the hook and pull it under the French braid. So we have a little bit more control with the hair than you would with the yarn when you're crocheting.
Eighth grader Nylasia Morrow is Lambert's club assistant. She joined the beauty club last year. Her favorite style to do is called a sew-in. This is where the client's hair is braided, and instead of being crocheted into the braid, it is sewn with a special type of thread.
After you sew it into your braids, you have like a part in the front where you don't braid, and then you will hot comb it, and then you will curl it or leave it straight.
Sixth grader Amina Rios Quinones has learned how to braid and put her hair into updos, but hairstyling isn't the only skill she's picking up.
I'm learning how to interact with other people and how to like talk with other people or how to do the hair or like help them with advice.
The students learn other beauty techniques. The club leader goes over a few of them.
Last week we learned how to put on acrylic nails. We also learned how to do eyelashes. They've done it on each other. I've done it on the students.
I can do nails, well, a little bit of nails.
That's sixth grader Taraya Rosario. Her favorite thing to do is to add fake nails with an acrylic overlay.
You gotta glue it on first. You gotta file it down. And then it's like this stuff, like this powder stuff. And you dip it in this like this watery stuff. And then you dip it in the powder and you lightly put it on there.
After it hardens, more filing is done to make the nail smooth. Lambert says she's shocked at how much last year students have grown. Hart keeps coming back to teach the girls because she says it's important for them to learn how to do their own hair.
They need to know how to be able to do the basics, the minimum, or even if it's a desire to go further and do more people's hair, you got to start somewhere.
Last year, the club had about 40 members. This year, it's around 60. In Rockford, I'm Yvonne Booz.
More to come on Statewide. Illinois lawmakers have passed a bill that would allow school districts to pay for extended motel stays for students facing homelessness. Isabella Nieto reports.
Illinois schools are already able to help families pay for housing. A new bill would add extended motel stays to the list of options school districts can help pay for. The bill's sponsor, Democratic Senator Karina Villa, says it will help students stay in school and their communities while they find a more permanent home.
When a student doesn't know where they'll sleep at night, it's so much harder for them to get to school, to focus on class, and to feel safe enough to learn.
The bill passed the Senate and now awaits the governor's approval. I'm Isabella Nieto.
More to come on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Every spring, high school students from across the country travel to Oklahoma to look at dirt. Actually, they're judging the dirt. This year, the National Land and Range Judging Contest attracted more than 700 students from Illinois and other states to sift through soil. The students are sharpening their eye for land suitable for crops, grazing, and home building. Harvest Public Media's Anna Pope attended the three-day event.
In a windy field about 30 minutes west of Oklahoma City, teenagers are climbing into deep pits in the ground. They're trying to get a better look at the soil ahead of tomorrow's competition. High school freshman Clay Cash is standing beside a big pile of dirt.
I've always been interested in this. I live on a farm, so kind of seeing how fertile the soil is and everything really plays a big part in my family's life.
Oklahoma's red clay soil is different from the ground in eastern Kentucky, where Cash is from. He and his team drove 15 hours to compete at the National Land and Range Judging Contest. He's been judging soil since the fourth grade. Last year, his team won the 4-H Kentucky State Championship, qualifying to compete at the national level at this event.
It's a very big deal for me. My sister's both done it, and she's in college now, but she got really close to making it here, but I'm glad I could kind of fulfill that dream for us.
Cash was one of about 750 4-H and FFA members from across the U.S. who made the cut to take part of this annual competition in Oklahoma. There are three events to assess the soil for crops and forestry, grazing, and home building. Across the field, junior Audie Usner has a handful of subsoil and is checking how fast water will run through it. The teenager from Central Texas has been competing for 2 years.
And I like winning. You know, we're at the national contest representing Texas, so, you know, that's what I like.
So state champs?
Runners up, but, you know, hey, we lost just barely, and we're going to prove them this week, I'll tell you what.
Knowing how to assess soil is important for growing crops, raising animals, but also choosing where to build a house or other structures, says Deanne Presley. She's a soil management extension specialist at Kansas State University.
The purpose of soil judging is to understand and study soils so that then later on when somebody says, well, why are we digging this hole or what can the soil be used for or could I put a railroad track here, you'd have something intelligent to say about that.
Understanding soil is important for a lot of industries, whether environmental sciences, agriculture, or civil engineering. Larry Wright is the coordinator for the national competition. He's been part of this event since 1978. And says the students will take what they've learned far into the future.
These individuals, like any contest, or where you can go from sports to this event, is to recognize that they have a skill that is valuable.
The next morning, students pack into cars, vans, trucks, and buses to travel to an undisclosed location for the contest. It's been kept a secret, so no one can get a head start.
We did it, everybody. You're here. Get in the zone. Time to compete. Follow your group leaders. We're gonna head off.
Students are given the rules. No phones and no talking. They'll have 4 fields to judge and 25 minutes for each. The contestants are looking at soil quality, the slope of the land, and risk of erosion. They scrape and measure, grab handfuls of dirt, and get low to the ground. Experts have already judged these sites. The students who come closest to those professional observations will win. After the judging ends, the teenagers gather for lunch and compare notes. Maddie Willis sits with her teammates from her North Central Indiana FFA chapter. The high school junior is happy with how things went.
I love being able to do this and just to be able to say that I play in dirt, but it's amazing to be able to meet all these people from around the world and make new friends and build the bonds I already have with my team and get a chance to just get out and learn more about agriculture.
She says the contest goes far beyond just looking at dirt. It's about understanding what's present in the soil and how to best use the land in the future. I'm Anna Pope, Harvest Public Media.
Welcome to This Week in Illinois History. I'm Clint Cargow. On May 17, 1955, the Illinois General Assembly approved the official state slogan, Land of Lincoln. Before that, it was the Prairie State. And before that, it was the Sucker State. During the 1800s, Illinoisans were known far and wide as suckers. The term originated in the mining regions of northwestern Illinois. Every spring, men from St. Louis and southern Illinois swarmed up the Mississippi River to work the mines. Every fall, they went home. Galena residents called them suckers because their travels resembled the migration of suckerfish, a Mississippi River bottom feeder that swam upstream each spring to spawn. The name stuck, and Illinois became the Sucker State. By 1850, newspapers nationwide used sucker interchangeably with Illinois. It confuses many historians studying Lincoln's rise to national prominence, as newspapers sometimes called him a tall sucker, a genuine sucker, or a distinguished sucker. The term even made its way into a campaign song.
The pride of the sucker, so lucky for Lincoln and liberty too.
A common misunderstanding relates to a famous story from 1858. Lincoln told a friend about his wife's ambition for him to become president. "Just think," Lincoln exclaimed, "of such a sucker as me as president." Historians often cite this as an example of Lincoln's wit and humility when he was actually just referring to himself as an Illinoisan. I'm Clint Cargyle, and I'll see you suckers next week.
Bath County, Kentucky celebrated an historic occurrence last month, the Meat Shower of 1876. That's when pieces of meat mysteriously fell from the sky onto a farm. Sherry Lawson with member station WEKU was at the festivities.
At the Bath County History Museum in rural Kentucky, dozens of people crowd around Kurt Godey. He's a professor at Transylvania University in Lexington.
We believe it's a sample from the meat ran of 1876.
He's holding a glass jar with the meat sample in a clear liquid. Godey has been fascinated with the meat shower for over 20 years.
And the pieces that rained in that storm ranged from the size of a hailstone to the size of Rebecca Crouch's hand.
Rebecca Crouch is the woman who witnessed the meat shower 150 years ago. She was outside making soap on her Bath County farm when pieces of what appeared to be raw meat rained on her under cloudless skies. In line to see the meat is Andrew Cruzy. He has a cabin in eastern Kentucky and has heard the meat shower story for years.
It's one of those things that you hear about and you assume it's kind of urban legend, but it's actually, there's a piece of it.
Some, like Sasha Reinhardt, are having their picture taken with the jar of meat. She believes she's a descendant of the Crouch family who experienced the meat rain.
It's definitely part of our oral tradition. Of course, you know, Appalachia's really big on storytelling, oral tradition, and this was always a favorite.
150 years ago, the story was heavily publicized in the New York Times and in scientific journals. There were several theories about what it was and why meat fell out of the sky. Theories ranged from it being a sign from God to a hoax, but Godey says the most accepted theory is that the meat was vulture vomit.
The idea ultimately there is that a flock of vultures was flying high enough above the farm that when Rebecca Crouch was hit with the meat, she looked up, she couldn't see them, and the whole flock disgorged at the same time.
He says they tested the meat in the university's gene sequencer.
Ultimately, the strands were not long enough to be completely conclusive, so we don't know exactly what it was, but we do know that it's closest to a goat.
It was one of those things as a child growing up here in Bath County that you learned it from your parents.
That's Ian Corbin, who grew up here.
We even had like a week in school where you had your local history of Bath County and you learned about it.
Now he has organized a festival around the event. He orchestrates meat-themed games in the town square, like a meatball toss and a bologna throw, where a thick piece of bologna is hurled like a frisbee.
Okay, all right. 1, 2, 3, throw! Go!
Vendors line the streets and sell things like T-shirts and mystery meat chili. At the town's library, author McSullivan reads his Meat Rain book to the kids.
Sometimes strange things happen.
Janie Rice's brother brought her two kids to the library to hear the story. She says she heard it from her father, who heard it from his father.
I think it's just a wonderful thing that this small community has decided to take what was a very strange occurrence and make it into something that the entire community can get behind and support.
At the end of the festival, hundreds of people stand around a white split rail fence near a field. A Cessna airplane flies over the area. 1,876 individually wrapped pieces of beef jerky spill out of the window.
There we go.
That's the work of Kurt Godey and his team. Thanks to them, a meat shower has rained in Bath County for the second time in 150 years. For NPR News, I'm Sherry Lawson in Bath County, Kentucky.
Legislation designed to save more people's lives is on its way to the governor's desk. And that bill was created by a Naperville high school student. Peter Medlin has the story.
Ashlyn Goldstein is a senior at Naperville Central High School, and she's going to school for nursing next year and has done a lot of CPR training, from Girl Scouts to a CNA course last summer. And last year is when she had a realization.
I've never seen a CPR mannequin that was female in my life, and I've been certified at least 5 times.
It led her to research about bystander CPR, that women who suffer a cardiac arrest in public are 27% less likely to receive CPR.
And basically the reason I found is people are scared.
They're afraid of inappropriately touching or hurting women.
People get scared and they hesitate. And when someone goes into cardiac arrest, I mean, people say every second matters for a lot of things, but it really is every second matters.
All Illinois high schools are required to teach CPR. So Goldstein's idea was, what if students learned on both male and female CPR mannequins?
My hope is by having more female mannequins in high schools, you're going to get a large group of people who are learning it and learning how to be comfortable with different anatomy in the case that someone goes into cardiac arrest in the real world.
But how do you go from a good idea to writing a piece of state legislation, especially as a student?
Yeah, I had zero experience with government in general before this. I mean, I hadn't even voted yet until this year. I wasn't even 18.
Luckily, she was in a capstone class at Naperville Central taught by Seth Brady. He's helped several students create legislation, work with local lawmakers, and get them passed into law, from topics like severe allergies to media literacy. And Goldstein spent the fall researching and prepping to pitch her plan. And at the end of the semester, she and a few classmates met with State Representatives Maura Hershauer and Janet Yang Rohr.
I was really nervous going into that meeting.
They asked her to clarify a few points and tweak some wording, and eventually, Representative Hershauer agreed to sponsor the bill. It was filed in February and assigned to the Education Policy Committee, where they quickly got feedback from the Illinois Principals Association that it needed amendments.
We pushed back the start date to a year later to give schools some more time, and then we removed the ratio of male to female mannequins, and we're just saying you have to have at least one.
It made the plan cheaper for school districts who'd have to buy additional mannequins or chest covers they could put on male mannequins they already have. And Goldstein emailed back and forth with Representative Hershauer asking if there was anything she could do to help. And one of the big things was getting people to fill out witness slips in support of the bill. She sent out mass emails giving step-by-step instructions on how to submit them to the state's website.
It was a lot of family, it was a lot of friends, some teachers. Just a lot of support from the community, and I've been very grateful.
They got 190 witness slips in support and only one in opposition. And it wasn't just friends and family either. A few healthcare nonprofits, including Illinois Heart Rescue, signed on. And a member of Illinois Heart Rescue also testified at a committee hearing. And Goldstein herself testified over Zoom and gave written testimony.
At the end of the day, I'm just glad that so many people are talking about it.
And Goldstein says people are taking notice.
I've heard of EMTs up in Chicago who heard about the bill and immediately went out and bought female mannequins. And so it is changing things.
She says the experience has been challenging, but empowering. Again, Goldstein was 17 when she came up with the idea. She had to look at a lot of flowcharts about the legislative process and was lucky to have a lot of teachers ready to answer her questions.
This really showed me that you can make change. If you set your mind to something, if you truly take advantage of all the resources and opportunities given to you.
I'm Peter Medlin.
If the governor signs the bill into law, schools that teach CPR classes will have to provide both breasted and non-breasted mannequins starting in 2029. We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for joining us. Be with us again next week for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.